My name is Jessica Yates with the International Security Program at CSIS. Today is the 9th of January, 2008. And I'll be interviewing Ambassador Robert Joseph, currently the U.S. Special Envoy for nuclear nonproliferation. This is part of a series of interviews taking place for the oral history component of the PONY project evaluating U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. We'd like to start with some biographical questions and just about your involvement with the MDA. You've already talked about this a little bit, but if you can briefly describe your career, if you can do it briefly, and more specifically, your involvement with the MDA in the various official capacities that you've had.
My career is basically a mix of government service and academia. I began working for the government as an intern while a graduate student at Columbia University. After teaching at Carleton College in Minnesota, I was asked to come to Washington and serve in an advisory capacity to Dr. Lynn Davis, who time was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense working nuclear affairs. In my advisory capacity, I worked for Dr. Davis on a number of nuclear issues, including the modernization of our nuclear forces in NATO Europe. I then went back into academia, teaching at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. After a year there, I was offered a position at NATO headquarters in the U.S. mission as the nuclear planning officer. I arrived in Brussels in July of 1982 to begin work on INF modernization and the implementation of the agreement to modernize our nuclear force posture in the alliance. I was the U.S. member to the Nuclear Planning Group staff group, the group that was responsible on a day-to-day basis for implementation of the agreement. I worked in Belgium for about 2.5 years. Went back to the Pentagon instead of returning to academia, which I had originally planned. But I went back to the Pentagon as an office director, working in the Office of Theater Nuclear Forces Policy, which again continued my involvement with nuclear matters. I then became the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Arms Control and Forces Policy, which dealt both with offensive modernization as well as arms control in the nuclear context, both for strategic and theater weapons and missile defense. Following that position, I took the position of Commissioner to the Standing Consultative Commission, dealing with the ABM Treaty and other arms control agreements that we had with the then Soviet Union. Following that and following the election of Bill Clinton, I went back into academia, serving at the National War College as a professor of strategic studies, and beginning the or founding the Center for Counterproliferation Research, which is now called the Center for the Study of Weapons of Mass Destruction. I joined the transition team in 2000 following the election of President Bush. I served on the NSC team. I was asked to join the NSC by Dr. Rice and did so in January of 2001, and served at the NSC in the capacity of Special Assistant to the President for Proliferation Strategy, et cetera, et cetera, and was there until November of 2004, left government briefly and came back in the spring of 2005 as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and left that position in February of 2007.
In which one of those capacities were you most involved with the U.S.-UK nuclear relationship?
I think throughout that time, I worked very closely with my UK counterparts, certainly in Brussels in the early 80s as we worked to deploy ground-launched cruise missiles and Pershing missiles. We worked exceptionally closely, not only because the United Kingdom was a basing country. In fact, it had two locations for the basing of ground-launched cruise missiles, including Greenham Common, but I think primarily because the UK was one of the clear leaders of the alliance and was a very important partner in both the success of the deployment track of the two-track decision, as well as the arms control track. So we worked very closely together on INF deployment and modernization. We worked very closely throughout the 80s on missile defense, and you'll recall Margaret Thatcher's prominent role in that context. And of course, I worked very closely with the British in the non-proliferation and counterproliferation areas, including the joint effort to encourage or compel, depending on the word one wants to use, the Libyan decision to give up its nuclear weapons program.
You talked before slightly or a little bit about the motive or the modernization of our nuclear forces. The MDA.
Sorry.
The modernization of our nuclear forces, the MDA kind of expressly covers the technical exchanges on the fabrication, design, and the development of the warhead itself. Did you have any involvement with the scientific element or the technical exchanges themselves? Was there kind of an interface between your job as a policymaker and the technical community?
No, not with the technical community. I dealt almost exclusively with the policy and operational communities.
Right. In 2004, they amended the treaty to extend it for 10 years. Were you a party to those negotiations? Did you have any involvement with that?
No, I did not. Other than a supporter on the sidelines.
Right. Something that we kind of want to take out of the oral history component is what can't be read in history books and, you know, Wikipedia pages. And just your personal relationship with the UK counterparts, and do you have any kind of anecdotal stories or comments you'd like to make that kind of shed light on how close that relationship was working with them, or any people that you could recall by name, maybe?
Well, I do recall very clearly and very fondly my relationships with my British counterparts throughout my career in government. At NATO headquarters, I worked very closely with Tony Paulson, who was their rep when I arrived to the NATO NPG staff group. David Gould, who has also had a very distinguished career in their civil service, was my counterpart for most of the time in Brussels. We had a very close professional and personal relationship. Our two families. I of course worked very closely in the context of the Libyan experience with William Earhart, who is now, I believe, the UK ambassador to Beijing. William was my counterpart in what was a very closely held and ultimately successful effort that was truly joint in every sense of the word, a major intelligence success story, and I think also a policy success story. I think that those successes could not have happened without the British being really full partners in this effort. And I think the key to success, quite frankly, in terms of the earlier deployments of INF missiles was a reflection also of the contributions that the British government made, as well as the other basing countries. I think this was one of the finest sort of moments of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, and I think ultimately the result, that is the deployment, despite the protests in the street and despite the Soviet determination to derail the deployments, which failed, had a major impact on the end of the Cold War and the defeat of the Soviet Union. Likewise, I think the British support and Maggie Thatcher's personal support and personal rapport with President Reagan on the issue of missile defense also had an impact on the Soviet decision to end the Cold War and to basically allow the demise of that government and of that empire.
I'm kind of interested to hear your thoughts on the Mutual Defense Agreement, 1958 Mutual Defense Agreement itself, the one that kind of codified the technical exchanges in design, and the kind of, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing because there's this unformalized special relationship that was developed in World War II. That sort of, you know, did that underlie the sort of formal mechanisms of the treaty, or do you think that the formal mechanisms of that treaty signed in 1958 have fortified the relationship, i.e. if World War II and the Manhattan Project had all happened, but then Britain had decided to continue with its nuclear program independently, what would the, you know, geopolitical balance of nuclear forces, what would the geostrategic nuclear environment look like? What would U.S.-UK relations look like? You know, would that bond that predated the treaty itself have been strong enough to maintain a special relationship throughout the 20th century, or I guess sort of ceteris paribus, how important was the treaty itself?
Well, I can only comment on this from my reading of history. I wasn't personally involved in either the Manhattan Project or right. or the 1958 Mutual Defense Agreement, or at least the negotiation of that agreement. My sense is it's not an either-or. My sense is that the special relationship existed even prior to World War II, and that our joint collaboration in the context of the Manhattan Project certainly stimulated the long-term special relationship that we've had in the area of nuclear policy and nuclear programs. I think that that experience was very important for building the foundation. I also think that the 1958 MDA was also very important in sustaining that special relationship in this area. It truly is unique. It's unique in many different ways. And I think that that uniqueness had to be built on something, and that something existed as a consequence of our relationship in the Manhattan Project and after that. But the 58 agreement was very important to continue to provide a foundation for this special relationship and this fusion of policy and operations and technology. Development and cooperation,
because it was a technical document that codified technical exchanges. Right. But it seems like implicit in that, is there a security guarantee or a component that a doctrinal relationship, despite it only relating to the technical element?
Well, I think that the fact that there is an agreement in 1958 on the technology is very important. To sustaining, as I said, the political relationship, the special relationship that we've had with the UK over the course of now a good number of decades. The agreement on the technical side is important for providing, you know, the legal framework for cooperation in the technology context, but it's much more. I think it's both a reflection and a perpetuation of that much deeper relationship.
But is it meaningful that we know each other's design of nuclear weapons?
Sure, absolutely.
Can you comment on that, maybe more specifically, how knowing the design, the kind of vulnerabilities in another country's forces, how that forges a bond?
Well, I don't think I can give you much insight on that.
Some kind of describe this implicit quid pro quo in which it was sort of understood that the net benefit of the technical exchanges under the MDA accrued to the UK in exchange for them supporting United States policy desires, more broadly writ in deterrence policy. Can you recall specific exchanges or interactions maybe when that quid pro quo became apparent?
Say that again.
A quid pro quo in which the technical exchange information on our nuclear weapons design, clearly they were benefiting in a technical sense because we had better computers, better codes, better design capability, but we made this agreement. But maybe is there an understanding that in exchange for getting the net benefit of that cooperation, they will support United States policy desires in other areas?
I'm not aware of any explicit sort of bargain,
more of an implicit one, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well,
whether this underlies their support for other policies like Iraq, potentially, or Libya.
No, I don't think one can make that connection. I would be uncomfortable making that connection. I do think, though, that because we have this broader strategic relationship, the inclination has been, at least until recently, and may continue today, has been that, you know, we are partners in a number of different ways, and that we should support each other. And so I think the going-in position is that, you know, we will be mutually supportive. And I think that is grounded in this special relationship that is in turn reflected in the fact that we would have this technology sort of cooperation and joint development. I can't imagine, you know, conducting the type of operation, I'll speak to something that I had personal experience in, the Libya operation with another country the way that we did. I mean, that was joint from the outset. It was mutually beneficial, but not in a sort of bargaining context. I mean, certainly a shared objective to get Libya out of the nuclear weapons business, but you know, this ability to work that closely together, to share operational information in the intelligence context, I think could only have happened with the British on this scale. Again, I think it's a reflection of this special relationship.
The history, common language.
Yeah, I think mostly the history.
Mostly
the history.
I guess the two examples you've already mentioned of recent examples of UK.
And it's also, I should say, we share the English language generally.
Two countries with
a number of other countries. Okay.
Oh, you're right.
And I would say that the relationship with the British is nevertheless different than with those other countries. And a lot of that difference, I think, is a reflection of our very close sort of policy, technical, and operational interactions in the nuclear field.
I'd like to hear your thoughts more on that, what you just said, if there are any specific.
Well, it was never, for example, it was never explicitly discussed, at least in my relationships with the British on Libya, that, you know, our ability to cooperate was based on the 1958 Mutual Defense Agreement. Okay, I mean, that's not the sort of conversations that one have, or even the sorts of thoughts that one has. But it was the cooperation was almost a given, given our history, and that's an important part of our history. It's become such a comfortable relationship that one doesn't have to trace back the...
Right. Yeah, obviously. In the Libya example, the UK in some sense even spearheaded the diplomatic channel, at least in the beginning of 2003, or got the ball rolling.
I'd be careful with that. Okay. I don't know that that's an accurate sort of reflection.
They were the intermediary that Saif al-Islam contacted, and then...
Well, the Libyans had established diplomatic relations with the British.
Right.
I have no doubt that what the Libyans wanted was to work this with us.
That's
right.
But they were the intermediary. No doubt that we.
They were the initial intermediary and a full partner.
Okay. But not only the diplomatic channel, also in their intelligence efforts, they gather quite a bit of intelligence in the collections efforts.
It was mutually beneficial relationship.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, we gave the British X and they gave us Y. It was a joint effort.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, there was no sort of barriers to full cooperation on both sides when it came to not just intelligence sharing, but intelligence operations. And the same was true on the policy side when we did sit down with the Libyans. It was William Earhart and myself, and it was seamless. In fact, there were fewer seams with the British than there would have been had we had an interagency sort of context to this.
That's really fascinating. Is there the intelligence expertise sharing that happens under the MDA relating to nuclear design? Mm-hmm. Does that have any impact on their intelligence gathering? Is there an interplay between the understanding the design of nuclear weapons and being better able to detect centrifuge, shipments?
I don't believe I can answer that question.
Okay, fair. I guess you already answered the question, but do you think that the formal nature of the treaty makes the UK a better broker for US interests? I mean, when you describe it as seamless, it seems like they have the same strategic vision and interests that we do when they're sitting at the negotiating table. Is that at all influenced by either the technical benefits that they get under the MDA, or not the MDA even explicitly, but just having these treaties in place?
I think having the treaties in place is an important factor in that.
Okay.
But I think at this point, the treaties have been in place so long that even though they continue to have importance, they're not the driver.
That's right. Factor. The war in Iraq. The invasion sort of, embodied the Bush strategy of WMD preemption. Did UK support for that doctrine?
Well, again, I would differ with your characterization. Okay. After 10 years and 17 UN Security Council resolutions, I wouldn't exactly call that preemption.
The Bush strategy to...
And there is no policy of preemption, and there is no strategy of preemption, as far as I know, and I happen to have a hand in writing the strategy. There is an acknowledgement of the possible use of preemption as a tool under extreme circumstances, a tool that is grounded in international law.
Would you mind if I interject? I was interviewing with Schlesinger earlier today, and he was talking about how the evolution...
It was Secretary Schlesinger.
Dr. Schlesinger. Yes.
Or Dr. Schlesinger.
He was mentioning how U.S. security doctrine had changed with the Cold War, and how we were trying to get the British on board with a change in deterrence policy. And I was just wondering, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. How has U.S. deterrence policy changed, and how has that been affected by the war in Iraq and those kind of developments?
That's a very intriguing question. It's a very good question. I'm not sure that one could find consensus on this side of the Atlantic with U.S.-only sort of participants on how deterrence strategy has changed. In fact, I know you couldn't find consensus. I mean, when you talk about deterrence, many people talk about old deterrence, Cold War deterrence based on sort of mutual assured destruction, if you will. My sense is that the most articulate sort of statement of the change in deterrence policy, or at least one of the most articulate, is the British White Paper, which identifies rogue states, and certainly this is the concern of the Bush administration as you trace the Bush administration's sort of evolution in terms of its own deterrence thinking. You go back to the first NDU speech in May of 2001, and you carry that through. There's clearly a focus on rogue states, Iran, North Korea, and the need to think differently about deterrence, particularly the need to move beyond thinking about deterrence based on retaliation only or offensive capability only, and the need to integrate defenses and other counterproliferation sort of measures into your deterrence posture. I think the British White Paper certainly talks about those types of threats as key to their own thinking about the future of Trident. Second, I think the British White Paper is very good in identifying what many in the United States have been unwilling to deal with intellectually, and that is the strategic uncertainties associated with Russia and China, and how our nuclear forces or our broader deterrence sort of posture should be shaped for dealing with those or hedging against those uncertainties. And again, I think the British have done a good job in articulating that those thoughts. There are many uncertainties associated with Russia in the future. But one thing that is certain is that, like China, you know, Russia's going to have nuclear weapons, and in Russia's case, they're going to have a lot of nuclear weapons. And that's something that we need to think about in terms of our own national security, again, for the future. We need to try to shape it, but we need to be realistic in that. And third, and I think the British White Paper does a good job, and that is sort of, you know, deterrence in being against states that might be willing to transfer nuclear material or nuclear weapons to terrorist groups. And that, I think, gives sort of a connection between state programs and what, in my view, is the preeminent threat that we face as a nation, and that's nuclear terrorism. Now, we haven't connected those lines, I think, in an intellectually satisfying way. That's something that we need to think a lot more about. But we have, I think, worked together, and clearly there were a lot of back and forth with the British. I know Frank Miller had a number of conversations when he was at the NSC. I had a number of conversations with the British about the changing nature of deterrence, both when I was at the NSC and we were putting out strategy document after strategy document, but also at the State Department. And it was at that point that the British were undertaking their assessment of the need for a Trident follow-on. But a lot more work needs to be done in that context on both sides of the Atlantic, and my sense is that would be something that we could do productively together. It's a good question, though.
I want to ask about the theater of nuclear forces in Europe, given your capacity as the director of the theater of nuclear forces in the middle of the 80s. As I've said a couple times, the purview of the MDA is limited to those design and fabrication questions and not their operation and deployment. But do you feel that the sort of relationships that were nurtured through the technical cooperation that was expressly a part of the MDA carried over to the way you resolve operational and doctrinal issues at NATO?
Yes, I do. And I think that, you know, the assignment of the UK strategic warheads to NATO is a reflection of that, and the integration of their strategic capability into NATO planning was a reflection of that sort of technical basis. But it's, again, it's much more than a technical basis. It's a reflection of a much broader and very unique relationship. The British also were very important, again, as alliance leaders, in making the INF decision, the decision to deploy ground launch and cruise missiles, a success in holding the alliance together. And the alliance did hold together, and it held together because of, I think, the courage that was demonstrated by the leadership of the key nations of the alliance at the time, and the British were certainly very prominent in that. Now, TNF today is much different than TNF was in the 70s and 80s. I mean, in 1979, I think we had over 7,000 theater nuclear forces in Europe as a result of the INF decision that was reduced to somewhat over 4,000. And as you know, the number today is a small fraction of what was there before.
There's kind of a tension in operational issues between the security and the safety of the weapon and the survivability, or the forces and the survivability of forces, whether they should be dispersed or centrally located, dispersed so they're more survivable, centrally located so that they're more secure. Do you feel that, or I've kind of heard talking to other people, that there is a different perspective on how to resolve that tension across the Atlantic? That did you find to run into those sort of operational problems with NATO allies or with the UK in particular? Do you have to make compromises? Or
I recall many discussions of that issue. I don't recall any sort of serious sort of effort in the context of, you know, moving theater nuclear forces entirely out of Europe. There were, of course, tactical operational questions. There were security and safety related questions. There were many questions that we had to deal with, and that was the purpose of working together in the nuclear planning group. Nothing unique there, as far as I recall, with the British.
Okay. They didn't contribute anything that stands out in your mind?
To what? They contributed a great deal, but to what?
Or to the nuclear planning group, or their perspective on how we should plan nuclear, their perspective on nuclear planning. Was it different?
No, I think they played a very prominent role, actually, in what was called the high-level group. I think there still is a high-level group, but this is a group that was created to implement the forces side of the two-track decision. And the British played a very important role. And I can take you through the one experience, and that was the decision that ultimately was announced in Montebello. The deployment of ground launch and cruise missiles was accompanied with the determination on the part of the alliance to reduce the shorter range, the number of shorter range nuclear forces in Europe. You'll recall we had everything from atomic demolition munitions to nuclear artillery to short range missiles to aircraft, and the numbers were over 7,000. When the alliance agreed to deploy, what was the number, 464 Glickums and 109, help me with this, Pershing missiles, they also agreed that they would cut the stockpile so that the overall stockpile would go down. I will never forget the briefing that the United States provided on nuclear requirements, which looked at the number of targets and, you know, the operational requirements, and it was briefed to the high level group, and the results were unsettling. I won't give you a specific number, but they certainly didn't meet the expectations of the other partners in the alliance. The British were, I think, very instrumental in their own analysis, which resulted in the number of about 4,200, which was announced at Montebello. So they provided the key to this sort of analysis that got us to that level.
What do you think the role is of our nuclear forces in Europe? Continued deployment of nuclear forces in Europe today?
But the security situation in Europe is fundamentally different than it was in the 1980s. The Red Army no longer divides Europe. You don't have millions of, you know, millions of men and women, you know, facing each other in full combat gear. You also don't have the same sort of prospects of escalation to a nuclear exchange. And I think the fact that our force posture has declined to the level that it has declined to is a reflection of that changed relationship. At the same time, you have a Russia that is at odds with many of our policies, the U.S. policies. You have Russia playing a number of different games that lead one to think about the uncertainties associated, the strategic uncertainties, as I said before, associated with the future of Russia. And I think that the NATO alliance is important to that. And I think the presence of a nuclear capability is important for the alliance. And I think that's generally shared by the allies.
Do you think that our tactical weapons there could aggravate those problems, or the?
No, I do think if you were to take them all out, you'd never get them back in, and that would be the end of sort of a nuclear component, and I don't think that would be wise strategically given what we don't know about the future and what we do know about Russia. Russia is modernizing and expanding its shorter range nuclear capabilities. It has actually put greater reliance on nuclear weapons than at any time in the past. It's changed its doctrine in terms of no first use.
And you don't think that any of that is in response to us?
Oh, no. It's in response to the fact that their Red Army, their conventional capability, has deteriorated, and they like nuclear weapons. They like missiles and nuclear weapons.
Do you think that we'll ever arrive at a point where we can eliminate all of our tactical weapons?
Oh, I don't know about ever. I don't do never or evers.
But I suppose, what would the relationship between the United States and Russia have to look like in order for us to arrive at a point where that would be possible?
Well, I'm resisting biting, but I will say, you know, the lamb and the lion lying down together sort of comes to mind.
There.
What do you think about?
And even then, it's not bad for the lamb to have a nuclear weapon or two.
What do you think about the ABM?
Just kidding on that.
In the Czech Republic, what has been the British reaction to that?
Yeah. Well, I think the British have been, going back to the days of Margaret Thatcher, very supportive on missile defense, both theater missile defense, or what we continue in some circles to call theater missile defense, but also strategic defenses. The British, of course, provide a certain capability in terms of Filingales, the radar capability that is important to our missile defense, our strategic defenses. And I think the British, as far as I know, at least my British counterparts, have been very understanding and have accepted sort of the strategic logic of strategic missile defense and how it fits in with today's sort of deterrent requirements, as well as providing a hedge if deterrence fails. And God knows, with, you know, governments like we have in Tehran, deterrence is not, in my view, as stable or as predictable as it has been in the past. And I don't think that there are very many people, and I think there are no serious people, that argue that we ought to have a deterrent relationship with Iran or North Korea based on mutual assured destruction. And the Brits are very supportive of that, at least my experience.
And including the continuation of missile defense?
Yeah.
Laser defense.
Yeah.
Cessation of U.S. testing. The first question I was going to ask is kind of more scientific, and maybe you don't have an opinion on this, but the cessation of U.S. testing ushered in what's known as stockpile stewardship. Are you familiar with that at all?
Very.
Okay. Well, the U.S. scientists had a deeper understanding of the physics of the weapon, the real physics of, you know, boron, the behavior of the weapon, after we stopped testing, because they couldn't sort of, you know, test those intuitions. So they, which is sort of what ushered in the stockpile stewardship program. Some directors at Los Alamos say that the UK scientists had that before, the cessation of testing because they didn't have the capable of computers or codes. So they had to think, the designers had to think more like physicists because they couldn't, they didn't have as capable of codes. Do you think that the UK contribution helped to bridge that gap between testing nuclear weapons and stockpile stewardship because of their kind of different perspective that they had?
Well, I don't know that the stockpile stewardship program is a panacea. Okay, I don't think that we have a good sense of the known unknowns, and I know we don't have a good sense of what is unknown. And there are many unknowns if you talk to nuclear physicists and weapons designers. Those few that still exist today that haven't retired. I don't know the level of our technical interactions on stockpile stewardship, but I believe it to be pretty close. And my instincts tell me that it would be mutually beneficial, that we would learn from the British and that they would learn from us as well. Now, we're, of course, paying billions and billions of dollars a year for stockpile stewardship, and we're floating the labs on this funding. Whether or not we can, policy-wise, they put much stock in the future of stockpile stewardship, I'm not. I'm skeptical.
What is the UK position on the resumption of testing?
I believe that their position, like our position, is, we do not intend to test, but that if we need to test for reliability or for safety or for effectiveness, if we need to test, we'll have to test. The United States, of course, has rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and this wasn't rejected by, the bare one-third necessary in the Senate. This was rejected by a majority of senators, including individuals like Senator Lugar, not known for their anti-arms control positions. There was, I think, a failure on the part of the Clinton administration to provide a convincing sort of rationale for CTBT, both as a non-proliferation inhibitor or a proliferation inhibitor, if you will, and also significant questions about verification and, in fact, the need to test in the future.
Mm-hmm. And
the Bush administration's position is that we will continue with the unilateral moratorium. But if we need to test, we'll go back and test. And that was the Clinton administration position, too.
Right. And since we're talking about extended deterrence, do you think that something like the CTBT or a real restraint on our ability to test could potentially damage the credibility of our extended deterrent and maybe provoke other states like, South Korea or something to reconsider
that? I know that that is a debatable point, but I feel very confident when I make the argument that as long as we need nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapons are critical to extended deterrence. I mean, extended deterrence is more than our nuclear sort of umbrella, but the nuclear component is very important. As long as we need nuclear weapons, they need to be safe, reliable, and effective. And a comprehensive test ban treaty would make it more difficult to go back to testing, even if we needed to, for one of those purposes. And so I think it could have a very detrimental effect. And I don't think that there is a shred of evidence to suggest that signing up to a CTBT is going to have any impact on the decisions of Tehran or Pyongyang or any other proliferation state. They're just not going to. And they don't need to test to have a nuclear capability.
I'd like to talk about UK nuclear posture for a little bit. The independence of the UK nuclear deterrent, the treaty is kind of broadly perceived to infringe upon their sovereignty and nuclear decision-making. To what extent is that the case? How independent or dependent are their nuclear forces? And how elemental was the treaty to that dependence?
This is the 58 treaty? I don't think I know the answer to that question.
Or just can you comment on the level of independence of their nuclear forces and the strategic implications of their lack of independence?
I think that someone like Frank Miller would be better able to answer that question.
Okay.
Have you talked to Frank? You really should. You need to talk to Frank. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
The Trident system now, it's the sub-based, right, and they're decreasing the size of their, right, arsenal. What do you think that's a positive development for global security or U.S. security interests? And their Trident system is up for renewal. Should that happen?
Look, I think the fact that the British have for a long time. Deployed a strategic nuclear capability is a good thing. It's a good thing for the United States. It's a good thing for NATO. And, of course, it's a good thing for the UK. The world would look, I think, a lot different if it was only sort of a U.S. sort of responsibility for the development and the deployment of nuclear weapons. I think that the fact that the British have made the decision to extend Trident, to modernize, is also very important because, quite frankly, as you look at the nuclear powers today, you find one unique situation, and that is the situation of the United States, which is failing to take any measures at all to modernize its nuclear capability. The British are moving forward with modernization. The French are moving forward. The Russians are moving forward. The Chinese are moving forward. The Indians, the Pakistanis, the Israelis. I think you can see the point. The fact that the UK is doing this is very positive, and I would hope would have an effect on thinking back here about the need for modernization. Modest modernization. I'm not talking about expansion of numbers, or I'm talking about replacement reliable warhead, or perhaps earth penetrator, if in fact the case can be made that there's a requirement for that based on today's threats.
The lack of modernization. Do you think that has a negative impact on the state of the nuclear scientific community? And in the event that we don't,
Course it does.
Yeah, in the event that we don't modernize, what should we do to revitalize the scientific community?
Well, that is, I think, a $64,000 question. The expertise in the operational community, which I think one clearly sees in decline. Just look at this experience that we had with Minot. And the cruise missiles going from nuclear armed cruise missiles going from Minot to Barksdale, I think is a reflection of the fact that we're not invested as we have been in our nuclear forces operationally. I think the same the same sort of deterioration, long term deterioration of capabilities, is apparent in the technical community. And it's not just the lack of testing. It's the lack of providing opportunities for young people to come in and know that they're contributing to do exciting things and know that they're contributing to our national security. And, again, I think that the situation is unique in the United States. We're allowing that atrophy to continue. And I don't sense that that's the same in any other nuclear weapon state.
What do you propose to be done? What ought to be done to correct that?
Well, I think that's something that we need to look at very closely. We need to study. We need to create these opportunities. But I think driving this will be a change in sort of the prevalent attitudes toward nuclear weapons that prevail today. And that attitude is that nuclear weapons play very little role in our deterrent posture or in our defense. And I just think that's fundamentally wrong. And it's not just extended deterrence. It's all of those other things. Well, it looks like they hung up.
Okay. I've even heard interviewing Richard Wagner. I'm not sure if you know him. He was kind of suggesting these.
Talk to him today.
Oh, okay. He was great.
Yeah, he's terrific, and he would be He would, yeah.
Yeah, well, I did.
He'd be much more informative than I
would. Well, he talked about some like sort of scientific initiatives where the scientists would get very, would participate in projects that were very close to nuclear weapons, but not quite there. So that, because I guess the problem is, what if we need them?
Sure.
And so we need to have them trained in that capability.
We do need them.
Right, yeah, but what if there was a point where we, you know, absolutely needed to modernize our forces and everyone was on board? Are you familiar with any, like, specific kind of scientific endeavors that enable...
I will let Rich speak to that. I mean, Rich is the expert.
The evolution of the relationship, you've been kind of intimately involved with nuclear policy for, you know, 3 decades now. Can you... True! That's a good thing. I've been involved in it, like, 4 months. Can you comment on the evolution of the relationship through that time? If you've seen it, or are there any events that are kind of memorable in your mind that impact the nature of the relationship or expanded the scope of cooperation?
Well, I think you've done a good job in talking about the history, and my sense is you have a good feel for the relationship during the Manhattan Project, following the Manhattan Project leading up to 1958. But our relationship, I think, was really still in the early stages in 58, and it evolved and matured after that. And I think you can see the beneficial results of that evolution in things like the successful deployment of INF. You can see it in the British support for missile defense. You can see it in the sort of evolution of our thinking on deterrence post-Cold War. You can see it today in things like the ability to operate together as closely as we did in Libya and in other areas. I'm going to have to.
Do you have to go?
Yeah, how are we doing on the questions?
Well, doesn't have all that much to do with the MDA, but it's very rare that you get to talk to somebody that has that much involvement in nuclear weapons as you do. And I just kind of want to know how you theorize the role of nuclear weapons. What is your conception of deterrence? What is their role in the world?
Well, I think we live in a very dangerous world. I think the world has changed fundamentally, and so has the role of nuclear weapons from the days of the Cold War. And I think that while we can reduce the reliance on nuclear weapons, and while we can reduce the number of nuclear weapons still play a very important role. I would just point out that I've always been on the more pragmatic side of this. I mean, I don't think that that it is by accident that the negotiation of the key arms control agreements that have resulted in the reduction of nuclear weapons have been done exclusively by Republican administrations. And I don't mean this as a partisan sort of statement, but if you look at START, if you look at INF, if you look at the Treaty of Moscow, if you look at all of those sort of negotiations that have actually led to the reduction by thousands and thousands of weapons, they have been done in Republican administrations. Administrations that at no time took the position that these reductions are good for the sake of arms control. These were reductions that could be made because our requirements changed. And I just think it's absolutely stunning, and it shows you the power of bad ideas, to look at the Clinton administration's record. Not one nuclear weapon was negotiated away. They were in the in the administration prior to that. They were in the administration that followed that. And what is the reason for that? Well, the reason for that is that the Clinton administration continued to stick, this is my view, my interpretation, with this notion that the ABM treaty and mutual assured destruction had to remain at the core of our relationship with Russia. Now, Russia was perfectly content, and it's understandable why they wanted to continue that sort of fiction. Okay, because that was sort of a throwback to the glory days when they were a superpower and they had equal status to the United States and they had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. Why would we buy into that? Why would we buy into that in the post-Cold War world? Not only did the ABM Treaty prohibit us from defending our country against new threats that were less predictable, and the odds of deterrence failure, I think, are higher, but it also made nuclear weapons sort of the principal currency of our relationship with Russia. And it was, you know, it was a lost opportunity, I think, to change fundamentally our relationship with Russia. And I would ask that you go back to the first NDU speech. Go back to the May 1st, 2001 speech that the president gave, a speech that was mischaracterized in the press as all about the ABM Treaty and missile defenses. It was much more. It was a different strategic vision. And in that strategic vision, nuclear weapons play an important role. Okay, he doesn't. That speech is not about nuclear weapons. It's about ballistic missile defense. It's about new threats. It's about non- and counterproliferation measures. But nuclear weapons are important. Reduced role, reduced numbers. That's all good. But because nuclear weapons play an important continuing role, we need to ensure that we have the ones that we need, and we develop and deploy and maintain those capabilities that are essential. Otherwise, I think we're going to live in a much more dangerous world and a much more proliferated world. And I think the one thing that we need to do that I would urge is that we take ideology out of the equation and we look at this in a very sort of hard-nosed, realistic fashion. Okay, it's, you know, it can be very inimical to good, sound policy as well as to our own national security to take an ideological view toward nuclear weapons and arms control.
You know, Wagner said that his British counterparts were less prone to do that. He thinks that they approach nuclear policy more pragmatically and as matters of consensus, and we approach it more ideologically. Do you see that split?
I think that's generally accurate. Generally. And I don't think I would have made that observation, but I think it's generally accurate.
Also, it's just interesting when you say we can make arms or cut our forces because the relations have changed in such a fashion that I'm not saying you can. I'm saying when we have made those cuts, because relationships have changed that enabled us to make those cuts.
I think that we ought to have a force posture that reflects our requirements. Have gone down.
But do you think that, does that flow in both ways? Do our force, do force cuts or changes in nuclear posture, can those affect the security dynamic? Can those productively impact the relation between states, or does it only flow in the other way?
I don't believe that there is any evidence to suggest that the size of the U.S. stockpile has any influence on decisions to proliferate by countries. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that. Do I think that it's important for us to fulfill our obligations under Article 6 of the NPT? Absolutely. I also think that we've got a tremendously positive record in doing that. And if you look at the reductions that have been made, again, by Republican administrations, the reductions that have been made are really very impressive, and no matter what category. I mean, you look at TNF, okay? So we had thousands and thousands of these things, okay? We're now down to very small numbers. I don't know if it's 98% that we've reduced or, you know, 95%, but it's well over 90%. If you look at throw weight, it's the same. If you look at yield, if you look at no matter what category, we have gone down substantially, much more so than any other country. That's not a bad thing, as long as we develop and deploy those capabilities that are necessary. And I think that with our increased conventional capabilities, with our capabilities in other areas, our requirements have gone down. And with the change in the threat profile, they have gone down, but they're still important. And it's that sense of importance that's missing in the national debate.
Okay. One slightly different vein. When you describe the cooperation with the United States and the British as seamless, do you think that this sort of cooperation is a template or a model for cooperation with other countries, or is it so rooted in history that it is an argument for multilateralism? Or
I just get the shivers when you say multilateralism. I don't know what that means. I mean, I'm big on multilateralism in the context of the Proliferation Security Initiative,
yeah,
or the Global Initiative, or other sort of
just for
tools.
Our relationships with other bilateral relationships with other countries. I'm limited to that.
I have trouble, and maybe it's my own lack of imagination, but I have trouble imagining our ability to establish a relationship like we have with the UK with any other country on nuclear weapons. I mean,
are there lessons from your experience with your UK counterparts that you think you could draw lessons from on this is how two democracies with different audiences and different security interests, this is how you come together and make meaningful outcomes and you compromise? Did we compromise? Were there examples when we had to compromise, or was it kind of, or were we so driven by that same strategic vision that it didn't require that?
Well, I mean, there's strategic vision and then there's reality, and you know, the reality is we've worked through many different problems with the British, just like we worked through many different problems with the alliance, with the NATO alliance partners, the other NATO alliance partners. There have been, you know, many compromises that have been made along the way. That's not negative. That's just the nature of dealing in a partnership like the NATO alliance, or a bilateral relationship like we have with the UK.
Can you think of any compromises that we've had to make? Times when.
Well, sure. I mentioned the Montebello decision,
right,
and you know, the level of reductions and the nature of the reductions that were made in the context of deploying INF, very clearly a compromise. The whole INF arms control initiative was part of a compromise that was fashioned out in the context of the 1979 decision, the two-track decision. Doesn't mean it's, you know, one track is more, you know, is negative and one track is positive. It's just a compromise, a way of moving forward.
I think I'm going to have some other smaller questions.
You're going to ask about PSI?
I'd love to. As I've written that down as an example of other global initiatives that involve the UK pretty intimately. What other initiatives are multilateral or bilateral initiatives such in the vein of the PSI do you think ought to be undertaken to prevent proliferation?
Well, there are other, this will demonstrate my multilateral credentials, there are other initiatives that we have taken. The 2002 G8 Global Partnership is an example. That came about because a number of us thought that it was rather peculiar that the United States taxpayer was paying for non-proliferation assistance programs when, in fact, those programs reflected an international responsibility because here's a threat to the entire international community. We fashioned this sort of way forward. Multilateral initiative in this context is the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism, which we have which we co-lead with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And here you have a situation in which U.S. and Russian sort of interests intersect. And when our interests intersect, we ought to do everything we can to cooperate. They don't intersect on missile defense. They do on nuclear terrorism. They do on shaping the future of nuclear energy. And by focusing on those areas where our interests are the same, we can have a very productive sort of relationship. And the Russians have brought a lot to the table and have been very sort of positive as co-leaders in both of these efforts, the nuclear energy effort and the global initiative to combat nuclear terrorism. that's another sort of multilateral effort that I think is very important.
Are there other initiatives that you think in the coming years should be undertaken, or how do things like the PSI? What's your model of that form of multilateral cooperation, kind of the non-binding but cooperative efforts?
Yeah,
I mean, look,
they're the traditional sort of non-proliferation way of doing business is sort of to seek the universality, often at the expense of, you know, the best outcome. So in some cases, you get the least common denominator because you negotiate this and you negotiate that, and that's the process.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The PSI approach was much different. It's you get together with a small group of people, and the Brits were the first ones that we were that we called in this context. You get together with a small group of countries that share the same interest. In the PSI case, the interest was stopping the trade and proliferation. And you develop sort of a set of standards or a set of requirements and commitments, and that was reflected in the statement of principles. And then you go off and you build individual and collective capacities. Okay, we've been doing this through interdiction exercises and law enforcement cooperation and information sharing. And that, I think, has been a very productive model. That model was used for the global initiative. There were some changes made. The Russians were brought in at the beginning. And in fact, the Russians were the first ones that we went to on the global initiative. That worked for the global initiative, because what we did is we, again, started with a small group of countries, different countries. The Brits were one of them, but, you know, instead of meeting in Paris and London and Rome, we went to Rabat and Ankara and Kazakhstan. I mean, because it's focused on nuclear terrorism, and, you know, the Russians brought in the Chinese. The Russians have been really good partners in that. But it was the PSI model,
yeah,
where you don't seek universality. You seek partners who have a common interest and who are willing to act proactively.
Why is the ROK not signed on? And I mean, what do countries perceive as the cost of signing on to the PSI?
Oh, the ROK. Their concern was that they would create a problem with the North Koreans, because the North Koreans are, yeah, exactly. The North Koreans are certainly a country of proliferation concern.
Yeah, and they're okay.
And I would say it was the government at the time in Seoul, a government that lacked any real principle or any real fortitude.
Young Bok might be more likely to sign on.
I don't know what position they will take. I think the likelihood is greater, but I don't know what position they will take. And in fact, I mean, even under the previous government, Korea did move to try to participate more in PSI. They simply didn't formally endorse it.
Mm.
But again, lack of fortitude and lack of principle.
Were those negotiations difficult, or because it's such a common good, preventing proliferation? Were there times when
My view in putting this together, and you know, I did the conceptual part of this, and John Bolton did the actual negotiations. John did a terrific job on bringing it all together. But my view was that we don't go out and try to collect members, particularly countries that were reluctant to join. The last thing that I think you want in this sort of a coalition are reluctant countries, because that sort of reluctance feeds on the other sort of on the dynamic of the interrelationships. What you want are countries that are committed. And if the South Koreans aren't committed, hey, God bless them. They can go their own way. And what you find over time, I think, with PSI and hopefully with the global initiative, is that participation in these coalitions, in these informal sort of groupings, becomes a standard of good non-proliferation behavior. And I think it has. And you can see, for example, the evolution of China's perspectives and policies regarding the Proliferation Security Initiative. When we first came out with the announcement, they said, well, this is illegal, and this, you know, this will undercut non-proliferation and all of those phony arguments. And now their position is they support the principles of PSI, and they, you know, I mean, they're very positive on PSI. They still haven't formally endorsed it, and again, that's because of the North Korea issue. Huh. All right.
Thank you so much. Sorry,
you're sure welcome.
Minutes over your time.
No. That's quite all right. And good luck with your project. And if there's anything I can do, let me know.
Okay.